From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Keith Carradine talks about life in a family of actors. Also, Finnish filmmaker Aki Kaurismäki tells us about his new movie. It's about a band of musicians from Siberia who play so badly they're told to go to America where people will swallow anything. Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Living Color, one of the few black groups playing hard rock. And critic Maureen Corrigan takes inspiration from three heroic writers who wrote in prison or in exile. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. and the Soviet Union have announced an agreement in principle on a pact to slash conventional non-nuclear forces in Europe. NPR's Anne Gerrels has this report.
The agreement comes at the end of more than 5 hours of talks today between Secretary of State Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze and years of negotiations. The agreement ensures the destruction of tens of thousands of tanks and limits other weapons from the Atlantic coast of Europe to the Ural Mountains in the Soviet Union. The major outstanding sticking points, limits on aircraft and verification procedures, were cleared away today. Shevardnadze said there are still questions about limits on helicopters, but he said that's not very difficult. While Baker and Shevardnadze cautioned final approval can only be given by their respective allies in NATO and the Warsaw Pact, the agreement in principle would seem to pave the way for a pan-European summit in November. The United States had said it would not attend this conference, designed to usher in the new post-Cold War Europe, until this old business had been concluded. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
The Philippine military is on a nationwide alert right now, faced with an army mutiny on the island of Mindanao. Army Chief of Staff Renato De Villa said that mutinous soldiers have seized a regional headquarters on the island in the southern Philippines. De Villa said not much is known about what's going on at the scene because the mutineers have evidently cut off communications to the island. The general said that no other units were taking part in the uprising, and he urged the mutineers to surrender. President Corazon Aquino has survived 6 coup attempts since she took office in February of 1986. Iraq's president, Saddam Hussein, made his first known visit to occupied Kuwait since his army invaded the country on August 2nd. Also today, he offered to release all French hostages held in Iraq, a response to the French peace proposal unveiled at the United Nations. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
It was a surprise visit today for the Iraqi leader. He had 2 meetings with senior military commanders, according to the Iraqi news agency. Iraq has deployed more than 400,000 soldiers in Kuwait. The trip comes at a time when the French president, François Mitterrand, is reviewing his forces in Saudi Arabia. Mitterrand is scheduled for a meeting with Saudi Arabia's King Fahd for talks about his 4-point peace plan, unveiled at the United Nations. The Saudis are concerned that the French proposal sends a message that Saddam can gain from his invasion. On Sunday, Saddam welcomed the French plan because he said the language was different from the others. Today, the Iraqi leader offered to release all French hostages if France sends a top diplomat to Baghdad. In Dahran, Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices were down again on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 16 points to close at 2,489.36. Volume was 135 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Keith Carradine belongs to a family of actors. His father is John Carradine, his older brother is David, and his younger brother is Robert. And the actress Martha Plimpton is Keith's daughter. Keith Carradine is the kind of actor who seems most at home in offbeat films, playing con men, artists, and womanizers. Robert Altman directed him in Nashville and Thieves Like Us. Alan Rudolph directed him in Choose Me, Trouble in Mind, and The Moderns. And Carradine starred in Louis Malle's film Pretty Baby. But this month on HBO, you can see Keith Carradine in the kind of role he seldom plays, a sensitive middle-class family man. Carradine plays the father of a boy who has been sexually molested by their priest. Carradine and his wife press charges and refuse to let the church buy them off. The name of the movie is Judgment. I wanted to know how Carradine's career veered away from the mainstream, making a role like this seem so out of character.
I generally tend to choose roles that are going to take me out of myself. That's where I get off. as a craftsman. The further I can play from my own personality or my own lifestyle or anything like that, the more entertained I am in my work. So maybe that has something to do with it, and the fact that my own life is basically, you know, fairly middle class. I mean, I'm married, I got kids, I have all of the usual attendant concerns, problems, joys of that kind of life.
When you were growing up, how close were you to your father's acting career? How much of... Were you ever on the set with him? Were there a lot of acting friends over at the house? Did you feel like this was a big actor family?
Well, it was certainly, I mean, growing up with Pa was distinctive. He was, his personality was very colorful and forceful. But he did not really, I think he tried to keep his children away from being, you know, backstage babies. The notion of having been born in a trunk, you know, in the middle of some road company somewhere. He really wanted us to have normal childhoods. There were occasions when he had acting friends over, but he was not that kind of a social person either. He wasn't a party goer. And I remember one party he gave, and I think it was the only one we ever had there at the house where there were some actor people over there for it. But apart from that, it was really, he tried to give us a really kind of normal home life. As normal as can be expected from, a Shakespearean actor who was as much of a character as he was. We were surrounded by great literature and classical music, and there was an atmosphere of that pervaded our lives simply because that was what interested him. But in terms of, I went to a public school, until I was in senior high school, then I went off to a boarding school, a prep school. But for the most part, I mean, I led a very normal life. He didn't take us on movie sets much.
Because you'd be a bother or because he wanted to just...
Well, I think he just wanted us kept away from it. I think that he wanted us to have normal lives. And I think that he was acutely aware of the influence that it might have on our later career choices if we spent too much time around his world. Maybe it was a reverse psychology because he was certainly delighted that as many of his sons went into acting as did, you know.
It's interesting. Your father, John Carradine, was a classical kind of actor, but he ended up doing zillions of horror films.
He had to make money. You know, he was raising seven boys, which is not cheap.
So what stage of his career was he in during your formative years?
He was doing a lot of the crap when I was growing up. Yeah. He was not real happy about it. You know, I mean, occasionally he would get something that he could sort of enjoy. And once in a while he would mount a theater production and he'd go and do some classical or semi-classical character, and that would renew his energy and his joy in what he his chosen career. But most of the time he was bringing unexpected luster to some pretty mediocre movies.
Wouldn't you, though, as a kid have been more interested in the horror films than Shakespeare anyways?
Well, yeah, I suppose there's a certain element of truth in that. But I was acutely aware, by the time I was very young, of what the classics meant, what they were. And I really did know the difference. And, I might even have been a little bit of a snob about it. Certainly by the time I was a teenager, there were things that I simply looked down my nose at because I thought they were so lowbrow.
Like what?
Well, I mean, certain kinds of films, certain kinds of music. I mean, I was very late to come to pop music. I listened much more to classical music, and when I started playing music and playing guitar, I was more of a folky than anything, because I thought that most rock and roll and pop music was banal and mindless. You know, I have come really full circle since those days.
Let me just ask you, I know your father filed for bankruptcy during one point when you were growing up. How did that happen?
Well, he went off to Africa. He had his first really well-paying gig that he'd had in a while, We did not grow up rich.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up culturally rich in my household, but we didn't have a lot of money. And this was during a particularly lean time, and he got a big sort of plum role in this Tarzan movie, and he was getting some good money. And they went off and shot it in Africa. He was playing the heavy, the father of the bad guys. There were like three of them, the father and his two evil sons. Gordon Scott was the handsome, suntanned hero. And when he finished shooting in Africa, he had a stop in London on his way home, and he went into a casino. During the night he was there and managed to gamble away not only his entire salary, but twice his entire salary. I think he might have been getting like $40,000 for the 8 weeks or something, which in those days was a lot of money. And I think he was $80,000 down at one point. And then he managed to get up to where he'd broken even And by the time it was 6 in the morning, and he left the casino and called my stepmother and told her he'd just gambled away his entire paycheck. That was the beginning of an interesting phase.
What was the family reaction to this?
We moved.
To a cheaper place, right?
You bet. Well, that didn't strike me as terribly expensive, the place we were in, but I guess it was probably twice the rent. You know, we were living in this big old rambling house with horses, and it was kind of a ranch. And we went from that to a sort of a Cracker Box tract home, and we all crammed into there. And that was really what life was like for the next 5 to 8 years. That was how we lived. It was very middle class, and in terms of income and material wealth. And that's how it was. I would go after school. I remember we didn't live too far from where we had moved. And I used to get on my bicycle after school and ride over to the old house and just sort of sit there longingly wishing for a return to the good old days.
Right. Yeah. Keith Carradine is my guest. You ended up staying with your father after your parents divorced. I think in those days it was really typical for mothers to have custody. How did you end up staying with your father?
Well, it was like the courts basically decided that, he was not as crazy as my mother. And that was the bottom line, you know. They were pretty wild people, but in some ways, his wildness was more acceptable and conventional than my mom's. She was pretty much a flower child in the mid-50s. She was way ahead of her time.
Uh-huh. You once told Seventeen magazine that...
God, did I talk to them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, amazing.
That you thought you were a potential juvenile delinquent without the guts to go in that direction.
Yeah, I suppose that's accurate. Yeah. A lot of things that I said 15 years ago, I would say, my God, did I say that? But I suppose that's a possibility. Well, I had certainly the seeds of rebellion within me. But, yeah, I suppose that I lacked the bottle to actually go out and, you know, blatantly break the law or do anything that would have gotten me incarcerated or something.
What were the things in your fantasies that you would have liked to do?
Oh, I don't know. I had friends who were stealing cars and stuff, and I was always sort of appalled that they did it, but I secretly was envious of their courage, you know. My rebellion was more personal.
In what way?
I did things to hurt myself, or at least to put myself in danger. I didn't really endanger anyone else, you know.
What's an example of how you'd put yourself in danger?
Well, the whole late 60s. I mean, I took virtually every drug available, with probably the exception of heroin, you know. I managed to go through that phase and survive it. A lot of people didn't, so I feel very fortunate.
Was that when you were already in Hollywood? You grew up in Hollywood. And, what am I saying?
Well,
but you know what I mean.
I kind of grew up in Hollywood. Yeah. I mean, my grandparents, where I lived a lot of my childhood, they were up north, Northern California and San Francisco. But I was already, yes, I was pursuing a career as an actor during that phase, yeah.
So you were really like one of the hippies in Hollywood, right?
Well, you know, you can say that, but on the other hand, I wasn't really, because I was already into earning money, you know, and
right.
Supposedly being a hippie was not about that. It was about sort of not connecting to that whole trip at all. I mean, there was certainly a phase when, you know, granted, yes, I was making money and paying my rent and all of that, but I refused to have a checking account. I refused to have a credit card. That was my sort of mild form of protest, you know, but I was still plugged into the capitalist machine. I wasn't kidding anybody but myself, I suppose.
Well, still, you had long hair, you were doing psychedelic drugs. I was wondering if that put you, if that typecast you early on into a certain kind of role, or, in the way directors or casting directors saw you.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I'm sure it did. At the time, I felt as though I was simply part of what was happening, you know, but I guess... when you've fallen into that kind of a bag, you tend to see yourself as being a part of a larger group than perhaps it really was. I mean, I was probably the only client of my agency, my theatrical agency, who showed up in tank tops, bare feet, and hair down to my chest. Oftentimes, I would come into the agency shirtless, you know, which seemed absolutely fine to me. Now that I look back on it, it was probably really shocking to some people, you know. I'm sure that might have influenced, to a certain extent, some of the opportunities I was given in the earlier part of my career.
All right. Keith Carradine is my guest, and he's starring in a new HBO movie called Judgment. Your brother, David, had the same father but a different mother, so you're stepbrothers.
We're half-brothers.
Half-brothers, I mean, right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up with your father, and he grew up with his mother?
Yeah, once his mother and my father separated, David stayed with his mother, yeah.
So did you really know each other very well when you were growing up?
Not really. I mean, I kind of had passing acquaintances with David, who was then Jack. He was born John Arthur, and he was called Jack.
How did he change it to David?
Well, he became David somewhere in the early 60s, I think, at the beginning of his career, when some agent suggested that he go by some other moniker than the old man's name.
Right.
So I'm not even sure how he chose David, but anyhow, that's what he hung on himself. You know, our relationship was really passing. I sort of admired him from afar because he was always a very dynamic personality. And he would show up for family dinners and things on occasion, you know. And I was always very impressed with him, and I kind of looked up to him. Until finally, when I was striking out on my own, it was actually just before I got out of high school, I went down and looked him up. I was down on a weekend away from boarding school with a couple of friends, and we went down to Hollywood and stayed at one of my friends' homes. And we looked David up one night. And that was really kind of the beginning of our relationship as brothers. And he took me under his wing. When I finally moved down to Hollywood, I was struggling along. I was sharing an apartment with a buddy in Venice Beach, and we were cooking Colonel Sanders' chicken for a living. Pretty squalid existence. But David came along and took me in and actually supported me for about 6 months and guided me into my, you know, my initial, you know, halting steps as an actor.
Were you ever up for the same roles early on?
We still are on occasion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I mean, you wouldn't think we would ever be, but we were both up for Bound for Glory. We were both up for the role of Woody Guthrie.
He got it.
He got it. We were both up for the role in Pretty Baby. I got that one.
Oh, so,
you
really?
Know, yeah, it's, you know, I certainly, it's interesting. There is great competition in this business, and to be in competition with your own family for the same part is kind of an odd thing, but it's a wonderful thing because if ever I was going to lose a part to somebody, I would certainly rather lose it to David than some guy that I don't know.
Right.
You know, we have great love for each other, and our competition is loving and supportive, you know, if there is any.
I have to ask you, you know his TV series Kung Fu?
Yeah, I know that one.
Yeah. There's a shot of you, isn't there? You know, the opening sequence?
Yes, I did the pilot.
Oh, okay.
I did the pilot, and I played the middle Kane. So I was supposed to be David at age, like, 18 or 20 or something like that.
Oh, that's you.
That's me.
You know where I recognize you? There's a shot in the opening sequence.
Yes.
In the temple, and you're one of the students, is that the right word?
That's right. Well, it's supposed to be sort of
a chronological
documentation of the growth of this character. See, you see him as a young child, then you see him as a teenager, which is me, and then finally it's David, the full-fledged, full-blown grasshopper. But David invited me. He asked me to come do the pilot. I was already, you know, I was enjoying some wonderful success in my career at that point. And to me, it certainly wasn't something that I needed in terms of my career, but it was an opportunity to take part in a kind of, in some way, a family project, you know. So they had me come over and I did the pilot. And then they used footage from that bit that I did for all the 3 years. They kept using that footage.
I see.
Every once in a while, I'd get a check for $14, you know, from whatever network it was, whatever production company it was. Warner Brothers, I guess.
All right. Well, you did one movie with your brothers David and Robert.
Yeah.
And that was The Long Riders, directed by Walter Hill. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful film, and there's two other sets of brothers in it.
The three, actually.
The Quaids.
The Quaids, the Keaches, and the Guests.
That's right, the Guests, that's right.
And Christopher Nicholas Guest, yeah.
Right. So was it fun to have three brothers in the same film?
It was a gas. I can't tell you how much fun it was. We had a ball. It was a kid's dream come true. Just to be able to get up every morning and put on a duster and a six gun and get on a horse and go out and ride and shoot and hoot and holler, you know. I mean, and get paid for that? I mean, this is unbelievable. It was like summer camp. And it was just a wonderful group, and there was a great kind of energy and spirit to the whole endeavor. It was a 12-week shoot that went on for 16 weeks because of weather problems and other things. And, you know, when you get to the end of a 16-week shoot, ordinarily you've had it. You cannot wait to get home, and you cannot wait to see the last of all those people you've been confronted with on a daily basis. But in this particular case, we were having so much fun that I don't think there's a man on that picture who wouldn't have gone on another 16 weeks gladly. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just a terrific experience.
I guess it's Keith Carradine, and he stars in a new HBO movie called Judgment. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Keith Carradine is my guest. I think the first movie that you were really noticed in was Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you played a real cad and then got to sing this really sensitive folk song, I'm Easy, which you wrote.
Yeah.
This is a movie where a lot of the actors were asked to write their own songs for it.
Mm-hmm.
That song won an Academy Award.
Yes.
And you recorded a couple albums and had a small career as a singer afterwards. How serious were you about your singing career then?
Well, I was serious about it. It was always a secondary pursuit of mine. The only reason I had a singing career was because of my movie career. The sales of my first record were quite wonderful because of the success of I'm Easy. My second record, which I thought was far superior artistically, didn't sell at all. And that was kind of disillusioning, you know.
How did you start working with Robert Altman?
Well, I walked into his office when he was going to do McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And, you know, it's a part of this young cowboy who comes up to use the whorehouse in the town of Presbyterian Church. And David's then agent and manager, a fellow named Saul Krugman, who's now gone, knew about the project and knew about this role and thought I'd be very right for it. And he arranged for me to meet with initially the producers and then with Mr. Altman. And I had, my hair was about 2 feet long when I met Bob. And I walked into his apartment office in Westwood. And it was one of the most bizarre meetings I've ever had. I wish they were all like that. Because usually they sit you down and they intimidate you and then they see how well you hold up, you know. But with Bob, it was so real and it had nothing to do with any of that stuff. It had to do with just who you were and how you behave, because that's the way he casts. He casts behavior. And he saw this kid walk into his office, and I think he probably knew within 15 or 20 seconds that he wanted me to play the part. But he was unwrapping this package that had been sent to him from Colombia. He'd been down there at the Cartagena Film Festival or something, and he came back with some pre-Columbian art, and he was unwrapping this parcel and showing it to me. I think, as I remember, it was a stone angel or something. And he said, well, we're going to do this movie up there. He says, I don't know about the hair. Well, maybe we can use it like it is. He says, it's not much of a part, but if you want to do it, you know, you want to do it? I said, well, yeah, sure. And that was it. I mean, there was no reading. There was no, you know, none of that stuff. He took a look at me and said, yeah, come on up.
There's another movie I want to ask you about. That's Pretty Baby, in which you played a photographer who's taken with a young girl who's growing up in a whorehouse and who becomes the photographer's model. And this was directed by Louis Malle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you played opposite the very young Brooke Shields. I mean, this is the role that launched her career. She was, what, 11 or 12?
She was 11 when we shot the picture. She turned 12 the last week of shooting.
What was it like working opposite the 11-year-old Brooke Shields? I mean, it was a very demanding role because she had to play very mature.
She had to play very mature, and which was to rationally approach an 11-year-old girl with romance on your mind is impossible, coming from the place of being a 26-year-old man, which is what I was at that point. The trick that I had to do in my head in order to make that work was to, rather than try to bring her to my level, was to simply reduce myself to the emotional level and remember what it felt like when I was 11 and when I had a crush on a girl in school. And that was really what I had to become in order to play that part, was in terms of my relationship with her, I had to go to the emotional level of 11 or 12 years old and simply remember myself at that point. Otherwise, it would have been impossible. I couldn't have dealt with it.
That's an interesting way of handling it.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a man with a child. It was a boy with a child from the point of view of we were contemporaries.
Do you have to make movies to make a living?
Yeah.
You do? Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Are you asking me if I'm independently wealthy?
Well, I got the feeling from the stories about your father that you probably weren't, but I never know when an actor's made enough money to be able to, you know, live off of.
Oh, please. Nowhere close. I mean, I wish that I could take some time off sometimes. I don't get enough time with my wife and kids. My work takes me away from home, you know. I mean, I've actually considered doing a television series on occasion just because it would keep me in Los Angeles and keep me around my family, but something just won't let me make that leap yet.
So how do you think your career divides between movies you feel you have to do and movies that you really want to do?
It's about 50-50, which makes me pretty fortunate in the overall you know, scope of things. I get to do about half what I can be feel passionate about and about half what I have to do to pay the bills, you know. Fortunately, the stuff that I do to pay the bills is still worthwhile stuff, you know. But it's difficult to get people to pay you, you know, a substantial salary to do something that has very little possibility of achieving any kind of commercial success. It just doesn't work that way. So, you know, the films that Alan and I do together, we never really got paid for. I mean, not much. So I will go off and I will do mainstream, middle-of-the-road television and things like that and, you know, make the money I need to make to be able to subsidize, you know, my career as an actor in art films.
Right. Do you have any other films coming out that you'd like us to know about?
Well, I did a film in Europe that no one may ever know about, called The Bachelor, which I have been screening on my own, trying to get an American distribution, which is, I feel like Sisyphus and his rock, you know, I keep pushing this thing towards the top of the mountain and something always happens and it goes dribbling back down again. And, it's quite a wonderful film. It's just, it's very European and the marketplace nowadays has very little room for this kind of movie. But it's quite a beautiful film. I screened it here in New York City last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and for you know, a possible distributor. I'm afraid nothing's going to come of that because the person is a fool. But the the audience were very intelligent and, in fact, saw the film for what it is, which is brilliant.
Any chance of a movie in the near future reuniting you with your brothers David and Robert?
There's always the chance, so we just have to find the right vehicle. You know, it's difficult for us to appear in a film together because people are so aware of the fact that we're related. So for us to play unrelated people would be difficult for an audience to accept. So I think that we have to find something where we can play family for it really to work.
Don't you have a brother who's not an actor?
Yeah, I got a few, actually.
Oh, that's right. You said there were seven when you were...
Well, there are eight of us all together, varying degrees of brotherhood. Yeah. No sisters.
Right.
As my father said, he could always make women, but he could never produce them.
Well, Keith Carradine, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Actor Keith Carradine, he stars in the HBO movie Judgment, which premieres October 13th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, composer, producer, and non-musician Brian Eno. He has a new album of songs he collaborated on with John Cale. This is from the new album.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Finnish film director Aki Korosmaki takes us on the road for his view of America. Korosmaki's new movie follows a Russian band as they try to make it in America playing rock and roll. Hard rock has been the province of white musicians. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from one of the few black groups in rock, Living Color. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews three books by three extraordinary men, men who wrote scholarly works relying on nothing but their extraordinary memories. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet President Gorbachev has sent a senior aide to the Middle East on what is called a special mission. The Soviet diplomat has already met with Jordan's King Hussein. Meantime, French President Mitterrand is also heading for the Middle East. A Cairo-based Arab diplomat said that his visit is intended to display his country's independence in foreign policy decision-making. Britain's chief opposition Labour Party has, in effect, endorsed Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's handling of the Persian Gulf crisis. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Labour, meeting at its annual conference, didn't come right out and endorse the Conservative Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, who Labour stands a good chance of defeating in the next election. But the party's senior members, in effect, dropped a resolution that would have called on Britain to get UN approval of its participation in the Gulf crisis. Though there was some strong internal dissent, Labour leader Neil Kinnock has avoided criticism of Mrs. Thatcher's handling of the Gulf crisis, and public support for British participation is generally high, though that could change if a military conflict begins. Britain has felt the consequences of the conflict. Gasoline has risen even more steeply here than in the U.S. to almost $5 a gallon. But when Britain brings its troop strength to an expected 15,000 in the Gulf, the Prime Minister won't have Labour publicly second-guessing her, at least not for now. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was in Kuwait today, meeting with military commanders there. It was the Iraqi leader's first reported visit to occupied Kuwait since the August 2nd invasion. In Washington, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan, today voiced his support for the deficit reduction deal hammered out by the White House and the congressional leadership. NPR's John Itzde has a report.
Greenspan told lawmakers at a congressional hearing that the budget summit has crafted what appears to be a credible, enforceable reduction in the budget deficit. If enacted, Greenspan said, the plan should reduce the government's drain on national savings, making more money available for private investment, which should spur long-term growth. Greenspan's seal of approval is important because he has suggested that a credible deficit reduction package would lead the Fed to take action to lower interest rates. Supporters of the package will be able to use the prospect of lower interest rates as a selling point for the deal. Lower rates could encourage borrowing and help stimulate the economy, making a recession less likely. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
In South Africa, a homemade bomb exploded outside the residence of the U.S. ambassador. There was some damage, but no injuries. The sound of the explosion was heard over a wide area. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 16 points to close at 2,489.36 on volume of some 135 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'll talk with Finland's most prolific filmmaker later on the show. The band Living Color has a new album, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. This is the title song from Time's Up.
In the history of rock and roll, there have been numerous instances of acts that all right-thinking people are supposed to like, but to whom listening is difficult. Everybody has an example of this. I agree, for instance, that Jim Morrison and the Doors were important figures in rock music history for the way they expanded notions of impressionistic lyrics and discursive song structures. But listening to Morrison's morose baritone has always wanted to make me get up and leave the room. You have your own examples of this sort of thing, I'm sure. You know you're supposed to think Patti Smith was revolutionary, but she gave you a headache, that sort of thing. This idea of rock music as good medicine is much in evidence these days, I think. Take, for example, the band Living Color. Led by guitarist Vernon Reid and singer Corey Glover, Living Color is this country's foremost black rock and roll band. That is, these black musicians have reappropriated the hard rock guitar attack and curt rhythms that have been associated almost exclusively with white musicians for two decades now. I admire the way Living Color is reclaiming all of rock for African-American players, but why is it that so much of the rock they want to take back is bad heavy metal? On Time's Up, there's a strain of self-righteousness that can be off-putting, a bore. One song, called Elvis is Dead, begins by making fun of the way Elvis Presley sightings pop up regularly in supermarket tabloids, not the most original observation, but then goes on to complain that Elvis shouldn't be called the king of rock and roll because Chuck Berry and or Little Richard deserve the crown. Elvis was a hero alone, but that's beside the point. A black man taught him how to sing. Hey, calling Elvis the king isn't a law, yet. In fact, more often than not, it's a joke. And who said that Chuck Berry and Little Richard fans can't call their heroes the king if they want to? On that same song, Living Color combines its contempt for what the band perceives as Presley's racism with a swipe at Paul Simon, with the clever couplet, "I've got a reason to believe we all won't be received in Graceland." But if Living Color is annoyed about Paul Simon's use of African music on Graceland, why does the most tuneful song on their album sound like a Graceland outtake? Living Color's first album, Vivid, had its own share of morose hectoring, but on cuts like Cult of Personality and Open Letter to a Landlord, it was funny and exhilarating, too. And to be sure, Time's Up has its solid moments, such as Love Rears Its Ugly Head.
I always thought that our relationship was cool. You play the role of having sense, I always played the fool. Now something's different, I don't know the reason why. Whenever we separate, I almost wanna cry. Oh no, please not that again. Love rears up its ugly head.
Most of the time, though, listening to Time's Up, I feel as if I'm trapped in a lecture I didn't sign up for. No matter how smart or how skilled the band is, how good can a record be if one's primary response to it is to stare at the speakers and say, I know, get on with it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Expressionism, postmodernism,
This is Fresh Air. Aki Korismaki and his brother Mika have a movie theater in Finland where they show independent films from around the world, offbeat movies like Jim Jarmusch's Mystery Train. Now Aki is getting a chance to have his own film shown in American theaters. He's Finland's most prolific filmmaker. In today's New York Times, he was described as having made 8 smashingly original films in 7 years. 2 of his movies are part of the current New York Film Festival. Another, Leningrad Cowboys Go America, premieres in New York November 2nd. The film begins in Siberia, where a band is auditioning for a producer from Melodia Records. The band is so bad, the producer tells them, "Go to America, they'll take anything there." And the rest of the film follows the band as they tour America, trying to learn English and trying to learn to play rock and roll. The band is played by an actual Finnish underground band that has become very popular. The movie is shot on location in American clubs and lounges. I asked Korismaki if he knew the kinds of places he was after.
Just took some cars and went on the road. And whenever I saw an interesting place, I said, stop here. And I went alone in the bar and said, asked one beer. And then after a while I said, well, I'm from Europe. I'm making a film, some kind of film here. Could I shoot here? And they said, normally, yes, of course, help yourself. And then I went to the door and whistled. And then 30 people came in with a sound studio and lamps and this and that. And 45 minutes, we were out. And the scene was made.
Hello.
Hi.
We are a rock and roll band. Can we play here?
Sure, help yourself.
50-50.
Okay.
In the film, they never heard of rock and roll before they come here. Nobody knows what rock and roll is. The manager buys them a book where there's some notes for rock and roll, and I thought it would be nice to start with Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay, to show their development in their first touch with American rock and roll.
When you were thinking, this band is supposed to be a really bad band, were you trying to imagine what the worst rock and roll band would look and sound like?
I've seen many lousy rock and roll bands, so I know how they'll sound.
Did you want to get some of that sound?
Well, of course, they couldn't play so bad because it would be torture for the audience, but there's a certain style that they don't sound like a professional box office band.
The way the band is dressed in the movie, first of all, they have these like pompadour hairdos that extend like cantilevers about a foot beyond their foreheads, and they all have like matching shoes that come to these foot-long points in front of their toes. Where did you come up with those hairdos and costumes?
Well, the hair, they had the style of the hair before, but I thought it's not balanced, so I made the shoes look like same so they don't fall down in the wind.
So you mean the Leningrad Cowboys actually wear those hairdos?
Yeah, but the next style they have is the Jewish rabbi style.
What?
A Jewish rabbi.
That's the style they also wear?
They will use it next.
In your movie, you have all the members of the band standing very upright when they perform. They walk in a straight line. They eat in a straight line. They sleep in a straight line. What were you getting at with that?
Well, for myself, I explained this is a picture of old Russian the class hierarchy, which is that the manager is the man who owns the land, and the band is the peasants, and the one village lunatic who runs after the car is the slave. I want to film somehow reflect the social systems of the world.
Now, apparently you and your brother produce about one-third of Finland's movie output.
That's a dirty lie. We produce half.
What is the state of the Finnish film industry? How many movies get made there? Is there much of an industry?
No, there were three quite big companies like ours and two others, but one of them made a bankrupt last week, so now there's only two. And we probably make a bankrupt next week, so...
Was there a way to apprentice other filmmakers when you were getting started, since there's so few of them in the country?
There was a older generation with different tradition, and then we started and we changed quite a lot the whole system.
What was the difference between your generation and your predecessors?
Well, there used to be a tradition of naturalistic epic films based on the books written in 30s or 40s or 20s, and more like a studio style and a Slav film style. And when we started to go back to the streets and take them ideas from modern nowadays life and backyards and back rooms and streets and bars. And we also documented what was left of Finnish culture.
What was left of Finnish culture? Is there not much Finnish culture left?
No, we have started to speak English nowadays. Advertising is already in English.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And have American and English movies always been popular there?
Yeah, and Finland has since 50s been most influenced of American culture than any other country in the world, I guess, in Europe anyway.
So when you were growing up, did you have to watch movies with subtitles?
Yeah.
Or did you speak English when you were young?
Well, not much, of course, but depends how young you mean. When I was 2 years old, I didn't even speak Finnish. But we have no dubbing in Finland. It's too small country for that. So all the films I saw with subtitling, which was good because I learned English when I heard it from the soundtrack, and I also saw it written. So I more or less learned English by watching television and films.
Now, you also run a film festival that's called the Midnight Sun Festival, and you hold it 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle during a time when the sun doesn't set. This seems very self-defeating to me, since you need it to be dark for the movies, right?
Yeah, but we show the movies inside. I had a dream of outside screenings, but it's quite impossible when the sun never goes down. That's why we are going to change the festival to be in January, when there is dark for 2 months and no sun at all.
Oh, are you really that?
And outside screenings, and all the guests who are over 70 get an extra blanket. The only thing is inside is the projector.
So tell me why you set your film festival so far north.
Because we had experience from film festivals where people never meet. They're in big cities and nobody ever sees anybody. And so we put it in a small place from far north, and it's 300 miles every direction. There's nothing except tundra, so nobody can escape and they have to talk. But in fact, we finished the festival last summer, and it was last fifth and last time, so it's goodbye now.
Oh, I see. You have two movies now that were just screened at the New York Film Festival.
Yeah, that's true.
One of them's called I Hired a Contract Killer, and the other, Match Factory Girl. Can you tell us a little bit about each of them?
Well, the Match Factory Girl is a very tiny little film of a tiny little Match Factory Girl. It's very much influenced by Bresson Dreyer style of filmmaking. And it's a little a minimal film, very short also. I Hired a Contract Killer is much bigger, and it's in English. Match Factory Girl is in Finnish. And the Contract Killer is shot in London with Jean-Pierre Leo and Margie Clark and Kenneth Colin. And it's some kind of a tragicomical crime film. But not too much blood in it.
I actually haven't seen Jean-Pierre Léo in a new movie in a long time. Our listeners will know him from a lot of François Truffaut's movies. How did you get to work with him in the movie?
Yeah, this was his first main role in 15 years. Well, I just used to admire him when I was young, and so I went to Paris and I called him and said, let's meet in the bar. And we met in the bar, and I said, I have this kind of idea, and I will pay you this much, and you have to do it in London in English. And he said, all right. Then I went home and wrote the script.
Were you happy with the way it worked out, working with him?
Yes, I'm very, very happy with the work of Jean-Pierre Léo. I'm not very happy with my own work, but I never am, so.
Do you plan on staying in the United States or making more movies here?
No, I make one in Paris and then one in Ireland. And after that, I don't know. I'd like to make another one here.
So you're truly an international filmmaker now.
Yes, it seems to be that I'm international in a way that I don't work in one place only.
And you distribute films from around the country. I mean, your interests seem to really be international.
Well, I'm interested to be a human being, but it's very hard for me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you.
Filmmaker Aki Kaurismäki.
He's a landing rock cowboy, raising cattle on the steps. Won't you pour him another vodka? 'Cause it's drinking to forget.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are looking at Germany, which is headed for a unity hangover, still celebrating today. In the Middle East, various high-ranking officials of various countries are practicing diplomacy around the Gulf. In this country, the president is still trying to sell the budget, especially to members of his own party in the House and Senate. And we have a political story from Florida. The incumbent Governor Martinez is running against former Senator Lawton Chiles. It's a contest of big money against little money and a test of negative advertising.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With all the books and computers we have access to these days, knowledge seems almost limitless. But commentator Maureen Corrigan thinks there's a difference between access to information and being passionate about it.
I've read thousands of books, but it depresses me how little I remember of most of them. Sure, I know that Darwin's Origin of Species said something about mutation, and that Plato talked about essence versus existence, but don't ask me the specifics. I sometimes wonder what would happen if all our libraries were destroyed, like the Great Library of Alexandria was in 391 AD. Could any of us recover from our own sluggish memories, the history, science, and literature that we've studied and supposedly know? I can think of three men in the 20th century whose knowledge ran so deep and who felt the need to remember was so crucial that they willed themselves to write scholarly books while they were in exile or imprisoned. For these men, writing was an act of saving civilization, a way to carry on when war and politics threatened to destroy their worlds. Eric Auerbach was a professor of Romance philology who wrote a book called Mimesis in 1936. It's a modest study of the history of representation, a way of seeing how everyday life has been reflected in all of Western art. Lots of scholars consider it one of the most brilliant works of criticism ever. But the story of how Auerbach wrote the book is just as amazing. When the Nazis came to power, Auerbach, who was a Jew, left Germany and escaped to Turkey. He couldn't use the libraries there, so he relied on his memory to cite whole passages of St. Augustine, Dante, and Virginia Woolf. The only hint Auerbach gave about how he wrote his book was in the epilogue, where he apologized for the lack of footnotes. Another man who found himself in Turkey in the 30s was Leon Trotsky. Trotsky was on the run from Stalin's assassins, so he was traveling light, without books or research notes. But in 13 intense weeks in 1932, he wrote his monumental 3-volume History of the Russian Revolution. But the person you'd want with you on a desert island, not for romance, but for intellectual stimulation, is Fernand Braudel. Braudel was one of this century's most innovative historians. He expanded the focus of history to include psychology, geography, folklore, as well as the study of kings and wars. He spent years in a Spanish archive jammed with thousands of documents from the 15th and 16th centuries. Braudel used an old movie camera to film the documents. He took around 3,000 shots a day. When he was ready to write his book, World War II began. He joined the French army, was captured by the Germans, and spent the war as a prisoner. Somehow, Braudel wrote his 2-volume book, The Mediterranean, in his cell, consulting only his memory. He wrote in school copybooks that he mailed one by one to safety. The Mediterranean was published in 1947, and it remains a landmark study. Writing was possible for these three men because they knew more than just how to retrieve information. They knew how to connect with ideas in their minds and in their hearts.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries on Fresh Air with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We meet two very different musicians on the next Fresh Air. Brian Eno brought electronics and avant-garde thinking into rock. And Robert Cray is updating the soul and blues music that first inspired him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.